True Crime Garage, and this is part 3 of When a Killer Calls.
Always very excited to have Mr. John Douglas here with us in the garage. This is the third time that you've come and graced us with your presence, and we are excited, as we always are, to chat with you. And today we're talking about your new book, When a Killer Calls. This is a fascinating story from the mid-80s that took place in South Carolina with a very horrific case and tragic case, but one that really not only will appeal to our listeners and appeals to me as kind of a case study, but the criminal, Larry Jean Bell, just fascinating and absolutely bizarre, his crimes that he committed and the way that he not just committed these crimes, but also emotionally tortured his victims and their families.
Right.
Mr. Douglas, one thing that I found incredibly fascinating about the details of your new book, it really hones in on a lot of the communications that Larry Jean Bell felt were necessary to him when committing the crimes that he did. And some killers communicate with the media, some with law enforcement. From your experience, why do you think some choose to communicate with the media and others choose to communicate with law enforcement?
I've had cases. I interviewed Dennis Schrader, the BTK strangler, and it was just they're all looking for power. All these crimes are a sense of power and control. And someone like Dennis Schrader or the Zodiac, it's they want more than just local attention. They want national, you know, attention. In the case of that I just wrote about, When a Killer Calls, I never really had a case, you know, like this before, because this signature, that's an aspect of the case that is not necessary to perpetrate the case, but it's a need that the subject has. And his need was to sadistically torture the families of Sherry Faye Smith. There were two victims involved, but Sherry Faye Smith giving him initially false hope that that their daughter was still alive, and then having the victim write a last will and testament that he would mail to the family, and Sherry Faye Smith is now saying goodbye to her family. It was just an unbelievable family, the religious and the faith, you know, that they had. I mean, it was emotionally draining for me and everyone else involved, you know, in the case. But this guy then, after the last will and testament, he sets up these communications. Initially, he's disguising his voice, and we send the tapes to the FBI lab, and they say he has some type of a monitoring device on the phone, which began to tell us something about his background, his profile, his intelligence. So he was changing his voice. As the case went on, after a period of time, he stopped using that that device because he was gaining confidence. He just felt that he was not catchable. No one would ever identify him. But when this case kept evolving and kept going on and on, and then I'm working with the families, I'm working with a sister, her sister named Dawn, to use as a bait, really, to get this guy to keep communicating with us, because the more he communicates, the more we begin to learn about him. But it was very difficult in the 80s because we had to keep him on the phone for such a long period of time, up to 15 minutes before we can put a traps and trace, and he was well aware of that. So I had to work with the sister of Sherry Faye Smith, and basically kind of give her like hostage negotiating skills, and mm-hmm. and that is like paraphrase and restate the content that he's trying to, whatever he's telling you, just keep like confirming that you understand what he's saying. But he was too sharp at that time. He would bail on us. But one of the worst things about this, I mean, it was horrific, was that the mother received some of the calls as well as the sister Dawn. And then the mother asked him, the mother says that my daughter knows she was going to die. And Belle says, yes, she did. And I gave her a choice. And she could pick drug overdose, gunshot, or suffocation. And your daughter selected suffocation. And so what he did, he proceeded to use duct tape while she was alive and duct taped her head. And then he waits. He waits days for the body to decompose before he tells the family, through now Dawn, the other sister, where we can find Sherry Faye Smith. And the reason that tells you something about him too, because he doesn't want to leave anything forensically for us to determine, like the cause of death, to locate any kind of hair and fiber evidence. But what we could see is that, and we knew about the duct tape just by the evidence, as she her hair, after he duct taped her head, he removed the duct tape because he didn't want to leave any fingerprints on the duct tape. And he would end up cutting some of the hair on her head to totally remove the duct tape from us. So it was just an unbelievable case. And to set up, he stopped communicating with us. That was a problem. When I finally went down there, he stopped communicating with the police, with the family. I had to get him to talk. I had to get him to get back on the phone. So I sat down with the investigative reporter and told the investigative reporter that I wanted her to come up with a story where Sherry Faye is buried. We want to have a memorial service. And I'm not going to write it for you. I can't do that as an agent, but I want to make it poetic. And we're going to set up at the gravesite. We're going to put a kind of a lectern, a white lectern with Sherry Faye's picture on it. And when I was at the house, I asked to see Sherry Faye's bedroom. And Dawn, her sister, showed me the bedroom. And in the bedroom were dozens upon dozens of koala bears. And I started thinking in my brain, what can I do here? What can I do? And I saw a small koala bear that was hanging from a string. And I took that. You pinch the shoulders and it opens up. And I'm thinking, without telling anyone, I'm going to use this at the gravesite. I'm going to have Dawn, who now he was targeting, Dawn, the other sister, place that at the gravesite on a flower. And the hope is, Nick, is that he will pique his curiosity, because we do know from the research that I conducted and my colleagues, they like to collect souvenirs, mementos relative to the crime. So did all those things. Unfortunately, from an investigative perspective, I had no control over this, but she was buried very, very close to the road, and he would not take that kind of risk. But we were monitoring the vehicles, and we would catch him another way. But had we not caught him another way that we talk about in the book, we would have come across him eventually, because we had his license plate number. He stopped along with other cars, and we were recording all of those vehicles. And from him, once we would do a criminal check, on these people who were stopping, we would find with him that he had a history. He had a criminal history of attempted abduction early on in his life. He was involved in obscene telephone calls. He tried to abduct a 9-year-old girl besides another teenager. So we would have got him sooner than later, but we got him other ways forensically.
One thing that I found incredibly fascinating, and I love when a great book comes out on a case, and particularly one that fits into this realm for me, where this is a case that I thought that I knew very well. And then I read your new book, When a Killer Calls, and figure out, I only knew kind of the tip of the iceberg here. There's a lot to digest and a lot to take in from your new book. Now, one thing I picked up while reading is that it almost appears to me in some bizarre way, and this is something I didn't know before, that Larry was in love, or in his own bizarre way, thought he was in love with Sherry Faye Smith.
Now, he would say later on that he was stalking her. He came across her in a parking lot, and so he was kind of surveilling her. And on that particular day of the abduction, she was with a boyfriend. They just left a pool party, and we would find out later on that he was in that parking lot. He was watching them. They were kissing, and then after that, they said goodbye to each other, her and her boyfriend, Richard, and he tailed her home. He follows her home very, very closely. Had she pulled into a driveway and pulled her vehicle up to the house, he never would have pulled into the driveway. Her house sat back about 200 yards from the mailbox. She stops her vehicle at the mailbox to check the mail. And at that point in time is when he pulls up behind her. His modus operandi, we knew he had a gun. We later would find out he had a gun. We assumed he would have something like that to gain that kind of control. He also had a camera, and he would was taking pictures of her, and he just comes across as a nice guy. And the guy, you know, people, they look at criminals. They think they look a certain way. This guy looks like your next door neighbor. He could be anyone. But once he got her close to his vehicle, and that's when, you know, when he grabbed her. But he had this fantasy, but the fantasy, you see, can only last a short period of time, because from the point of abduction to the point of killing her, it was only several hours. And so he had to perpetuate this. And that's why then he shifted over to the sister. And then first he was very, very nice, very, very polite to her. But then he goes out and he abducts and kills a 9-year-old child who's playing in front of her residence. The family just moved into this trailer park, and she's out in the yard. Very boldly pulls up in front and grabs this 9-year-old child, takes off with her to get a description of the vehicle, but not enough, a good enough description to where we can identify him. And he waits and waits and waits. And then he calls up the first family, the Smith family, and Dawn. And he tells Dawn, he says, you know, remember that abduction the other day, that girl, Deborah Helmick? And she says, yes. She says, well, he gives her these directions, the directions where we can find the body. And like her sister, he waited for the body to be in advanced stages of decomposition before he gave us the location, you know, of her. But all this began, and we did a profile. The police department, the Lexington Police Department, it was tremendous department. Both the sheriff and the undersheriff attended the FBI National Academy, which is an 11-week program. And the FBI trains about 1,000 police officers a year worldwide. And so they took classes. One of the classes they took was in my area, in criminal profiling, criminal psychology. Like so many cops, once they go back to their department, they'll think they'll never have a case like this. And sure enough, here they get hit by this case, and then they contact us. And we for your listeners, we don't always go out on cases. In fact, most of the cases are kind of older cases when we get them, old dog cases. But if we're involved in a case where the offender is killing, and now he's killing again, and you probably want to kill one more time if we don't identify him, we're going out. It's just like an Atlanta child killing case. I mean, I was receiving calls early on, developing an analysis, but there was so many killings, so now I have to go on site. I got to see for myself and work with the investigators, on site. So this department, they were very, very, very open to suggestions and to proactive techniques. This is like 1985, Nick, in June. 19, you know, of my background, in 1983, mm-hmm. the end of 83, November, December, I nearly died on the Green River murder case. I was just burned out, had viral encephalitis, and came home in a wheelchair. So I really lost my confidence, and I didn't know if I would miss a beat. And so by now, in 1984, I nearly had to die before I could get help. So now they give me agents from the field, who I'm selecting, or good investigators to train them, but it takes a while to train them. So here, this case comes up now in mid 85. Now I got to go out. I got to go on site and provide on site consultation. I'm going to bring a relatively new agent, good agent, but a relatively new agent in my program. With me, the profile that we did turned out to be very, very accurate. I think we just missed the age. We thought he'd be between the late 20s to early 30s, he was about 34, 35, which isn't bad. Everything else about him, we felt he would have some kind of electrical background. He was an electrician, body type. We felt he would be a slovenly type. We felt he was obsessive compulsive. Reasoning for that is because you can tell when he was calling the family, he would follow a script. If he was asked a question in the middle of his lecture to say to Dawn or the mother, it would throw him off. So then he had to repeat himself. And so he would be this obsessive compulsive type, kind of a guy who you go into his garage, he'd have outlined where the screwdriver hangs or where the hammer hangs. He would outline that in his clothes. It would be very orderly and in his closet, and his personal appearance would look the same, or his vehicle. And we felt a guy like this could not have any kind of a normal relationship with women, that he probably was previously married in the past, which he turned out he was previously married, had a son, the criminal history, he had that, as I mentioned earlier, he had, all of that. So you can do the profile, but then you have to really, in fact, when I retired from the Bureau in the last couple of years, I was kind of getting away from the demographic profile, Nick. I wanted more to get into proactive techniques. I wanted the public to know more about characteristics or the behavioral patterns. Because if you develop a profile, then you release it publicly, you're trying to develop leads. But say you miss the age, you're saying the guy's a high school dropout, the guy may have a college degree, but everything else may fit. Well, the person may say, gee, everything fits this guy who I know, but the education is off. So I was getting away from that, but focusing more on pre-offense behavior and post-offense behavior. What was the behavior leading up to the crime? What would have happened to him after the crime? Like this case, we told the police he will be changing his personal appearance, we believe, which he did do. So things like that. And then what can I do to maybe cause the subject to inject himself into the police investigation, to go to the gravesite? I had to keep him contacting the family, which was very stressful. Mr. Smith, I was kind of hemming and hawing about what I was going to what was on my mind, how I wanted to use the daughter as kind of a lure. And John, tell me what's on your mind? What are you thinking? You tell me. I said, well, Mr. Smith, and I said, we're dealing with somebody here. He's not the type who's going to pull into this driveway and hurt anyone. He's not that type. But I can see what's happening here is that he's transferring, his fondness, his fantasy towards Dawn here. And I need Dawn. We need Dawn to lure him in and to get him to communicate with us. And then he agreed. He agreed with me. And Dawn, another one, very religious family. She's part of a church in South Carolina, and she preaches, has a beautiful voice. She sings. The Sherry Fay, beautiful girl. Here it is on a Friday, May 31st. She's graduating Sunday from high school. She's going to sing the national anthem at her graduation. I communicate with the family to this day. I mean, all these years, and they set up a fund for Sherry Fay Smith that I participated in raising money for a scholarship because she wanted to go into music. So it's just emotionally. I just had my physical the other day, and the doctor said, "How do you do sleeping, John? How do you sleep?" And I said, "I can't sleep. I have a very difficult time sleeping here." I said, "If it was me, I'd get up at 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, but my wife wouldn't appreciate it because I just think of stuff. I'm just always thinking of things or cases that are on my desk or work that I'm currently involved in."
I mean, the job, your career almost took your life. I remember reading in one of your earlier books where you said you were working so much that you almost prayed that you would You would try to think about the cases up to the point of falling asleep to hope that you would dream about the cases so you could continue working while you're sleeping.
Yeah, I would go to bed, it was quiet, everything's quiet, and I have a trying to come up with ideas. Help me come up with ideas. And I kept a pad of paper, and if I wake up and I thought of something, I would write it down because I'm afraid I was going to forget about it. You know, what's interesting, Nick, is that people, they watch television, they see the shows and everything, but the degree today, well, a new degree is kind of forensic psychology, but there are so many people, so many young people too. And majority of my audiences too, when I go out and do public speaking, 89% are women. They're interested in this field, but I have to tell them, this job, it can be hazardous to your health. And it's not just me, it's to the other people that were in my unit, because you really have to throw yourself into it, understanding and walking in the shoes of the subject as well as the victim. And you're not working one case at a time. At any given time, the agents that in my unit, we were doing 1,000 cases a year for 12 agent profiles and myself. And we had, I also was training Secret Service, was training training them. You would think that they had a program. They didn't even have a program like this. You would think they would have trained Secret Service, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. The volume of work and the nature of the work, and that's why right leading up to the time where I nearly died, I'm up in New York training a couple hundred cops. And I know my material very well, so my mouth is talking, but my brain is thinking of these cases. I got to go up to Alaska, where a guy named Robert Hansen, the unsub, is up there abducting women and then hunting them down like wild animals. He would fly up into the wilderness, strip them down naked, and hunt them down. I got to go to Seattle, King County, to work on the Green River murder case, and have all these other cases. So I have an anxiety attack, Nick. I think I'm going to I'm having a heart attack, and the audience, because I know my material, so my mouth is moving, but I'm sweating, my heart's pounding, and I'm saying to myself, regroup, gotta regroup. So I regrouped, and no one really detected anything, as far as I know. But when I came back to Quantico, I knew something's going to happen to me. I may die, something bad. So I took out income protection insurance. I took out extra life insurance. I didn't tell anyone, didn't tell my family or anything. But the day I had to go out on the Green River murder case, I said goodbye to my wife at home. And then she's a school teacher, and I drove over to say goodbye to her again. And why are you going out there? Why are you doing this? I said, I have to. They're asking for on-site consultation. I have to train these two new agents. They assigned me to my unit. You don't look well, your eyes. I said, well, yeah, I have a tremendous headache. What was happening, Nick, was my brain was swelling up, and apparently later on, the doctors say my immune system was just so low. And when I came back in a wheelchair from this from the Green River murder case, in fact, I was going to be buried. I'm a veteran as well, and I was going to be buried at the veteran cemetery. They were making plans because I collapsed back at the hotel room, and as you know, you probably read Mindhunter, and I know you did. And I thought I was getting a flu, and my brain was swelling. And I told the agents, it's Tuesday night. I'll see you Friday when we head back to Quantico and back to D.C. And they said, okay, we'll see you Friday. And I told them what to do when I go back to the task force. Well, that night I collapsed, and I remained on that floor until Friday, until they kicked down the door. But when they found me, my body was in a frog-like position, and they said every 30 seconds to a minute, my body started shaking, just trembling like crazy, and my face would become distorted. Emergency people came, first responders. My body temperature was between 104, 107, and what happened was my brain split in my right temporal lobe, which would cause temporary, I was amazing how I got over this, but temporary paralysis. But they thought for sure that I was going to I was going to die from that. And it made me, though, Nick, it made me a better leader, a good leader, because the people that do this work, they throw themselves into it. And when I would see people in my unit who are giving every drop of sweat and blood to help others, I would tell them to go home. And then they start to go home, but with the cases, they said, no, you leave the cases here. But you see, in the Bureau, it is so bureaucratic. You're not supposed to allow agents to do that. You got to sign in and sign out. And so I would break all the rules, but it just made me a better person here. But I keep getting caught in the abyss. I keep I would go out to the cemetery where I was going to be buried, and I look for my date when I feel like, oh, here it goes. I have no control over what's going on. I have just so many cases and so many calls coming in from whether it's profile. I was also a hostage negotiator. So these young kids, that's when I go out, I tell them, I say, this is not like like a 60-minute show or something that you're watching on television. Right. And when you see this death and dying, and it's not just even murders, it's victims of rape and these child abductions, child killings, and then the impact, how it has on the families. And I have families, Nick, that, and this is unbelievable, who want me to tell them, in a case of, say, a homicide, how their daughter, how their child died, what did the killer specifically do? Did my child suffer, or did she die quickly? Did my child put up a fight? And at first, I couldn't do it, but then they get mad at you, and it's just like when family members, they want to go in the morgue. And I didn't realize this until I was working with victims of violent crime. They want to see for themselves what took place to their loved one. And so you think you're protecting them, but no, you can't go in there. But they get angry. No, they want to see for themselves. They want to just to see what their loved one went through and suffered. So it's emotionally draining. It's just and when you work so many cases, it has a cumulative effect, on you. So I had to go see a shrink when I came back, kind of like Tony Soprano going to a shrink. The test they gave me, they said, you burn the candle at both ends. This didn't get you. You could have a heart attack. And I was exercising, but I was exercising to the point of exhausting myself, just trying to kind of numb my feelings, I couldn't do it. I really couldn't do it. So when they finally gave me help, just because they give you help doesn't mean you could train somebody overnight. It takes about 2 years to train somebody. And like in any profession, it takes about 5 years before they really start getting good, at what they do. Mm-hmm. I know I'm talking a lot, Nick.
Fine. And you're right. I'm still trying to get good at what I do, but it's, you didn't have to pinch yourself to know that you were human. It's your heart and it's your soul that really infected your brain. And the stress is what almost took you down, because I can only imagine you're sitting there, you're being moved all over the country to take on these different adventures. But here you are in New York and trying to teach and what you know better, inside you're better equipping these law enforcement officers to increase their toolbox and do a better job, become more efficient at what they do. So you Right. are helping, but the whole time in the back of your mind, you're going, what am I doing here? If I'm not in Alaska, then we're losing lives, not saving lives. And then while in Alaska dealing with bad Bob Hansen, you're in the back of your mind, you're going, why am I not in Washington? There are people getting at a crazy and alarming rate in the state of Washington at the same time. So I cannot imagine the stress and the anxiety that can cause.
Well, then, Nick, other thing too, Nick, is, and it's kind of like that. It was in the Mindhunter Netflix series. Is that I got involved in this. I just wanted to be a good instructor. I was the youngest agent when I came back to Quantico. I had about 7 years in the field, had 4 years in the military, 7 years in the field, hostage negotiator, also bank robbery coordinator. I remember on a SWAT team, a couple advanced degrees at that point in time. But I was the youngest one. And auditing the classes, these instructors, they didn't have their facts right. And they were being challenged by those National Academy students in the class who worked the Charles Manson case with David Berkowitz, the son of Sam. So I just wanted to be a good instructor. And so that's I came up with the idea of go into the prisons and let's talk to the experts. And then you have Dr. Ann Burgess joins us from Boston College, and she was also at the University of Penn. She was at both universities, came and to her job, it's not like Netflix, how they the show, how she's telling us how to do interviews. No, she's basically an academic, telling us how to develop the academic instruments for the interviews. As far as the interviews itself, now we're doing that, or developing the proactive, techniques. We're doing, all that kind of stuff. So the other thing, and we didn't have the blessing. I didn't have the blessing of necessarily the FBI either in the early days. I mean, if Hoover was alive, this could never even have been accomplished at all. He never would have done this. And then after he died in 1972, there was still, what is this behavioral science, this BS kind of stuff, why are you doing that? Why are you going to these prisons? Why are you doing these, these interviews? So you didn't have the support necessarily from the Bureau. And then when you go out to the cops initially too, it's like they didn't trust us because we were FBI, and they thought in the days of Hoover, we had the agency would dominate the police, or take the police would work a case, and in comes the Bureau to swoop up the case from the local police, and so I wanted to change that. And by the time I left the Bureau, it was interesting. It was a situation where we got so tight with the local police, and really then our agents in charge of our offices out in the field office. So say a case would go down, they were calling us directly, and you tell them you have to go through headquarters, the Criminal Investigative Division. No, we want to talk directly to you and your unit. You have to go. And so eventually we was okay, here's what you do, or here, special agent in charge of the Cleveland FBI, you got a kidnapping here, you're going to go before the press. This is what you say, this is what you don't say. And then headquarters would get on us, like, what the hell are you doing? Telling the agent in charge what to do. Well, he's asking us. He's asking us. So that caused a lot of stress. Just see, how you're being treated within the agency, then outside the agency. But then we, as time went on, we were pretty welcome and always give credit to the local police. They're the ones, and the police, or if it's an FBI case, the agents, whatever agency, you're going to solve it. I'm just a tool in your toolbox, that I may be able to help you. I may not be able to help you. And people don't realize too, it's not just these kind of cases. I've worked public in my unit, public corruption cases, foreign counterintelligence. We did assessments in those kind of cases, and arsons and bombings, product tampering, the Tylenol case out of Chicago. So all kinds of cases, product tampering, all types of cases that we did. So we had a great, it was a great bunch of people that we had doing a lot of work back then.
We were lucky enough to have Dr. Ann Burgess on just a few weeks ago.
Is that right?
Yeah, it was fascinating to talk with her. But
she is, her area is in victim, with the victim. She did, did a lot. She's amazing. I mean, for her age, and she's still going at it. But like I said, when she came down, it's really funny because the Wendy character, she's Anne's, as you know, is a nurse forensic nursing.
Yep.
But they have this like a psychologist in the Mindhunter series, and then her character is a lesbian, and is not a lesbian. She's married with several, several children. But I did a presentation with her at Boston College up there, and they were really thrilled with her that she got, this attention. Although they Hollywoodized her role, they Hollywoodized Mike Holden Ford, the actors, playing like my role, and everyone's hoping that there'll be a season three. The actors want a season three. It's up to David Fincher, the director, and whether or not there'll be. It was supposed to be a five-part series, five parts, and here they ended with two. But they took a year. They take a year for each of those 10 episodes, and a year for the 9. And they were filmed in the Pittsburgh, up in the Pittsburgh area. So they had to all relocate. Jonathan Groff, who played my role, Holden Ford, he lives up in that area, so there was no problem with him. But Fincher is just so obsessive compulsive that in season two, with the first episode, the actors were telling me this, that there was a barbecue scene where Bill Tench, like my partner, he's barbecuing, flipping hamburgers and hot dogs in his backyard, and the neighbors are over. And they start asking him questions. What do you do? I'm at the behavioral science unit, and I do interviews. And they get really engrossed in that. They repeated that 74 or 75 times, that one scene of flipping hot dogs and hamburgers. 75. And some actors can't take it, but they can't do that. That's why I had a girlfriend in season one. The actress who she just lasted 1 year. Holden Ford thought he was going to have this relationship, and they would live happily ever after. No, it was a great actress, but it's just can you be that? It's really strict, and over and over to get it. And that's why he makes these unbelievable movies. Or House of Cards, was amazing series on Netflix.
Well, in season two, there's that the big case, obviously, is the Atlanta child killings. And
right.
If we do make it to season three, I mean, you lived the life. What would be the big case? Would there be one big case, or would it be, do you think it'd be more like season one? I know you're not fully in charge here, but would it be more like season one, where it's a lot of smaller cases and a smaller involvement?
I had very little input. Surprisingly, the actors were surprised themselves. I had very little input from the writer at all. The whole McCallany came down here, stayed with me at my house and everything. He really dives into it. Jonathan Groff, who plays me, I didn't meet him until after the fact. And if you're using Mindhunter as a guide, well, Mindhunter, I thought I was going to be a one book wonder. I can't. So I only could touch on the cases, Atlanta child killing. There were so many other. And just like the Larry Jean Bell case, you'll touch on it, but you won't go deep. You don't have time to go deep, deep into it like you can in a single book. But there are so many cases. I mean, they could do the Alaskan case. They could do the Trailside Killer. They could do John Wayne Gacy. They could do Ted Bundy. They could do. I mean, there's just so many of them. They could do Zodiac. Doesn't have to solve the Zodiac, because it's really not solved. But you could do a case like that. You could Tylenol case or a Unabomber case. There's so many other smaller cases that you could do. I mean, those who've read or know my involvement in Atlanta case, it didn't happen like that, where I'm checking into a motel and the woman checking me in ends up inviting me out. I think in the show, it's like I'm going to go out on a date or something with her, but she ends up bringing me to where where many of the victims' family are waiting to try to get my involvement, get involved in that case. It didn't go down like that. And if anything, when I went down on the case, I mean, they raised hell with me. And it was a case where I only case, I think the only, maybe the only Asian who was censured censured and then got a letter of commendation and an incentive award for the same case. You know, they hate you, then they love you. Have a love-hate relationship, you know, with you. They hated me when I came back from England. I was training in the military. I'm down in Virginia and talking to people in corrections. And here a hand goes up. What about this guy they just arrested in Atlanta? And I said, well, I said, if he turns out to be the Atlanta child killer, he's going to be good for many. He's good for many. Well, the crap hit the fan, man. The Bureau looks at that as I'm a spokesperson now for the agent in charge of the investigation. I thought I was going to be fired. And then as the case started going and moving along, did the assessment, the profile, and then got involved in with the prosecutors and coached the prosecutors and then criticized the way the case was going. Like one day the hair and fiber expert from the defense took the stand and looked like the John F. Kennedy Jr. Good looking guy. Didn't know shit from Shinola about hair and forensics, but the jurors loved him. They loved how good he was. He was speaking to them. And so that afternoon, they had this big conference, you know, and they go around the room. Did you hear that guy, you know, talk about hair and fiber? He didn't know what the hell he was talking about. And going around like the horn around this big table. What do you think, John? I said, you guys are losing the case. You're losing the case. He may not know, you know, what he's talking about, but you guys from Bureau and from GBI, Georgia Bureau Investigation, you're so damn technical. I have no idea what you're even saying. Mm-hmm. It doesn't even make sense to me. And I know half this as much as at least as the jurors. So they would throw me out of there. They would, you know, send me back to Quantico. Then I tell them this one time. I told them, hey, I said, just so you know, Wayne Williams is going to get sick in the courtroom 1 week from today. I'll get out of here. I go back to Quantico. Williams gets sick in the courtroom. And I told him before why he will get sick in the courtroom. And then the next thing you know, get your ass back here. So I had to go back to, I spent 5 months down there and then got involved in coaching the prosecutor, great guy, Jack Mallard, on how to cross-examine Williams, because I knew he would take the stand. And Al Binder, who was the defense attorney, he's a great guy. I got to meet him really when we weren't, you know, when he wasn't cross-examining me or anybody else. I knew he would put Williams on the stand because they were losing, but I knew Williams couldn't take it, you know, take any cross-examination. So I worked with Jack Mallard, and he did a tremendous job and broke him down on the stand. And I know you've got that FBI profiler over there, and he's pointing in my direction. You're not going to get me to fit it. And your listeners may know that right now they're doing an investigation down there because they're trying to determine, you know, he was convicted of two. When we were down there, we thought maybe 8 to 10 were related. The other ones, we couldn't see a relationship here. But all those cases, 28, 26 cases were closed by the police. So they are looking, the parents are demanding that the police look at these other cases, which I was told they were doing.
Yeah, and that has always fascinated me as well, because I kind of feel like, and this is just very basic psychology and very my limited understanding. Of course, I'm no expert here, but I look at a case like that and I see, I don't know if Wayne Williams, it doesn't seem likely to me that the female victims are his.
You're exactly right.
And it doesn't seem likely to me either that maybe the white victims are his either.
Right.
He seemed to play within a certain sandbox, if you will, and right, those ones were out of that box, and I don't know that unless it was some kind of learning curve, or you know, that he was working on, maybe there is some kind of mix up there, but it looks highly likely to me that there may have been another serial offender operating, sure, roughly about the same time.
Right. Every year I was down there, I was looking. Every year in Atlanta, they have between 10 to 12 child killings down there. And a lot of those are even domestic related, mm-hmm, types of cases. See, at the time, though, at the time when this the case was going on, all the parents wanted to be on that list, to be on the list, even though some of the way they were, the kids were killed was totally different than the way I believe the ones we selected, how Williams was responsible. But they wanted to be on the list for, because there was compensation involved with Sammy Davis Jr. was down there, Frank Sinatra putting on a big presentation, singing, singing and raising money. You know, they raised millions of dollars, which they would then give to the families. So everyone wanted that child, even though no one's going to stop them, they were compensated. But I knew darn well, and you mentioned, Nick, those two females, like I didn't want Angela Lanier. No, you know, how she was killed, panties were stuffed in her mouth. It's ligature strangulation. Totally different. Mm-hmm. And some of the other ones too had like multiple stab wounds. The big thing with me was in that case was to say that the offender would be black. Statistically, it's white, mm-hmm. but generally, when you look at crimes, crimes are intra racial. Now you will have an offender cross over. Say he was targeting black, it will go with white. But they have we call it preferential victim, preferential age, preferential sex, or even a look, a certain look. We had one in the Midwest one time was women with red hair. So there's this, this preference. So with him, he thought of himself with he was a ham operator. He had a little radio station. He can only broadcast a few blocks in his neighborhood. He thought he was going to develop the next Jackson 5. But there was mishandling on that case by even by us. It was mishandled when he was stopped on that bridge. They could have taken him in. They could have taken him in for questioning. So they look in the car. They see ligatures in the back of the back seat of the car here. You know, it's like 1 or 2 o'clock. In the morning. When a car stopped, they hear a splash in the water. But they didn't do it. And then the interview that took place. I was down there, but I didn't get to do the interview. They were way too hard. They were way too aggressive. With him on an interview, and just by looking, it looked like he wanted to talk, and he kind of hung around the office, afterwards. The interview. And some people are good at it, and some people are not. And when you look at a case, say like Georgia, this case, or you look at Larry Jean Bell, mm-hmm. or from a book, I'm Gonna Kill a Calls. Why will he talk? I mean, well, he faces the death penalty. He's a child killer, and child killers are low in the totem pole in prison. Oftentimes, you have to segregate them because they're out to get him. So what can I do? I'm not going to do an interrogation. I'm not going to do an interview. Not an interview. I want to have a conversation with him. But you have to provide some type of a face-saving scenario. You have to give them a way out. Give them an excuse, whether there's like another side of the personality, they have like multiple personality, they're insane, or sometimes you have to investigators may not like this, but you have to almost project the blame onto the victim, that the victim was the seducer, and you panic, to get the confession, out of the person, to put in there doing it. That's what you're trying to do. So mistakes were made, but to clear all of those cases was wrong, in my opinion, and a lot of people's opinion.
Which is so bizarre, the psychology of it, because you almost, sitting across from the killer at the table, you almost have to empathize with the stress that the criminal put on themselves by committing these acts, and the choices and reactions that they had to make in the heat of the moment. You almost have to empathize with that, where we have a criminal like Larry Jean Bell and Wayne Williams who are incapable of empathizing with the people that they are killing. It's a weird, bizarre situation.
Yes. It's you're portraying even false empathy, whether it's Bell, I got involved in the interview. I wasn't supposed to. Mm-hmm. You coach others, but then when you bring them into the room, Ryan and the agent, Ron Walker, who came with me, and it was funny, Donnie Myers, they call them solicitors down here, not prosecutors. And he said, you know, these boys here, you know, these boys are from the FBI, and they profiled you, Larry, to a T. They profiled you. Everything about you came true. And Bell's just looking at us, you know. And then they just leave. They leave Bell with us in this room. And this was not planned. They had him for hours and hours, the police did, trying to interview him. He really never fessed up to anything. And so sat him down on the couch, and just coincidentally, I happened to be wearing I got a call like 2 in the morning. We were down there. You know, they got this guy now, and Larry Jean Bell, and I put on his kind of whitish pants and a white shirt. It looked clinical, and it turned out to be, it was pretty good. It wasn't done purposely. And so I'm sitting right in front of him on like a table, coffee table. I just kind of give him a historical view of what we do and what I found in those prison interviews. It's like people, Larry, who I spoke to, I never use the word murder, killed, or any of that kind of stuff, you know, to do that. But they tell me it's almost like, you know, two different sides of them. There's a side that, good side and a bad side. And when they perpetrate the crime, they know they did it, but it's like a dreamlike. They're almost like in a dreamlike state. And I do this long soliloquy. I go on and on and on. And he's just looking at me, nodding with me. Mm-hmm. And then I say, when did you start feeling bad about this case, Larry? I mean, and he said, and he's just staring at me. He says, when I saw the funeral, and I saw the newspaper articles and pictures of the family at the cemetery, and that's when I felt bad. You see, so I mean, why? Then I shift from that, and I get into this, you know, this side. It could be two sides. And then the closest he would come to confession was he says, all I know is that the good Larry Jean Bell couldn't have done something like this, but the bad Larry Jean Bell, you know, could have done that. And so that was as close as we came. And then I presented him in front of Mrs. Smith and Dawn. And I coached them a little bit to tell them, when you hear him say, I know it's you, I know it's you, I know, I recognize your voice. I did that, and he did the same routine, the good versus the bad. Good Larry Jean Bell couldn't have done this, but the bad Larry Jean Bell could have. And he would go to trial. The evidence was just overwhelming. I'm not going to tell the audience of how it got a really good lead. I'll leave that part part out, because it was really interesting how we got on to him.
Did you have to testify against Bell?
Yes. Yeah, I did. And a good prosecutor, he got me on a stand. I talked about the interview. You know, there wasn't really much he could get me on, you know, on there. And afterwards, we talked. Hey, you were pretty good. you were good on the stand. All this other, you know, BS stuff. But yeah, he was trying to save him from the death penalty. And I knew. And I told the prosecutor, the solicitor, I said, the only thing they're going to try here is an insanity defense. So what you're going to see starting day one, you're going to see this guy, flipping out in the courtroom in front of the jurors and everyone to show that he's, that's his only chance. I mean, we got it. His goose is cooked. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what he did. And then he would take the stand and he did the same ranting and raving, you know, I'm God and all that. Well, it took the jurors, I think it was like 45 minutes, 48 minutes to convict him on this case. And as well, it was another trial on Deborah Helmick and the same thing, you know, over there. And then he was sentenced, got the death penalty. The thing that surprised me is he could have taken lethal injection or the electric chair, and he took the electric chair, which he's such a coward. And I think in his mind, and that happened in 1996 is when he was executed, is that he just wanted to show, I think, even like how tough he is, a tough guy, you know, because everyone would have been on him, from the prison guards to the inmates, being this child killer, you coward and everything. So he could have taken the lethal injection, but here he picks the electric chair, which is could be pretty brutal.
Yeah, I had always wondered about that, if that was kind of a last ditch effort to, you know, prove that he's insane almost, right? Like the normal person would pick lethal injection. This sure. picks the electric chair. Not to to circle back too far, but why did you think that Wayne Williams would get sick in court or pretend to be sick? Right.
What happened is that Al Binder was the prosecutor and defense attorney, and Jim Kitchens was the other defense attorney. I got to meet with him, and they were shocked to find out that I was in the courtroom the whole time, because they were going to bring in a psychologist from Arizona to testify that Williams didn't do it. It wasn't responsible. They were shocked. But anyway, so they put Williams on the stand, and what they wanted to show to take the stand on the cross-examination, Al Binder's nickname was Jaws, is that, look at this guy, look at him. He looks like the Pillsbury Doughboy. Look at his hands. Are these the hands of a killer, of a serial killer? Look at these hands here. And so, no one was going to buy this, the jurors. And I said, his only ploy here is that once we cross-examine him, he's going to have to claim that he's sick, there's some sickness. He's going to be a sympathy ploy. And so I ended up coaching Jack Mallard, the prosecutor, and another prosecutor, Gordon Miller, was there. And because they were shocked when I said 1 week from today, he's going to get sick in the courtroom, and he did. And I told Jack, I said, Jack, because when he gets the stand, it's your choice here. I said, the defense attorney grabbed his hands. You touch his hands. And then when you touch his hands, say in a real low voice, what was it like, Wayne? What was it like, Wayne, when you wrapped your fingers around Terry Pugh's throat? Did you panic, Wayne? Did you panic? And he says, in a weak voice, no. And then he realized what he just confessed. So then he gets up and he starts screaming and yelling. That's when he does the pointing. Because the next day in the papers, an artist's conception drawing, artist in the courtroom had him pointing and saying, I know you got this FBI profiler over here and you got to try to get me to fit it. And you're fitting it perfectly. They never should have let him take the stand, at all. And I got to meet the prosecutors, and Mary Welcome was one of the defense attorneys. There was three of them there. And I was hair and fiber evidence, but it was such unique fiber evidence. And the big expert for the Bureau was a guy, agent by Hal Deadman. He testified, plus the GBI. But they only found, it was interesting, they only found the evidence on the cases that myself and Roy Hazelwood from the unit, we thought were related, these cases. And that was what's interesting, is that's what the lab only found it on those particular cases, not these other ones.
Early in your career, you spent a lot of time interviewing serial killers behind, prison walls. Mm-hmm. And one thing that I found, this is just a personal question here. And I've studied your career through your books, over the years. And, Kemper was always somebody that you had said was one of the more interesting interviews, because he was able to articulate what he did, why he did, and he was willing to speak about it. Now, in Kemper's case, he is one of these rare specimens that he kills once he gets out, when he gets into his early 20s, but he was already locked up at age 15 for killing his grandparents. I wondered, had you and Bob Ressler ever been in a situation where you were interviewing a juvenile, a serial murderer?
After they were convicted, Monty Rissell out of Alexandria, who killed sex workers. And he was seen a psychologist. He was only like in his teens. And the psychologist was giving him a true bill of health. This is a great guy, kind of like Kemper. And meanwhile, psychiatrist didn't realize this guy was doing all these killings around the Alexandria, Virginia, area. I have gone before parole boards. In fact, I met just yesterday with a parole board head who did the book, The Killer across the table, a couple of books back, and mm-hmm. and Joseph McGowan was one of the ones who killed McGowan was a school teacher who kills a brownie, 7 years of age, going house to house selling cookies, and on this particular day she was collecting money and knocks on this guy McGowan's door, and they picked me because he got to do the interview. They heard me doing like a talk show on a radio, but kind of like today we have podcasts. And he said, we got to get this guy down here to, McGowan's getting ready to get out of, out of prison. He served 30 years. That's the maximum sentence. So they bring me to prison up in New Jersey, which is very intimidating. Intimidating prison to begin with, and they put me in a room. I tell them what I want, how I want the room, the furniture, and everything. They introduce me to him, and so I have to go now on a fishing and a hunt here to try to let's see what this guy's if he's changed, has he been rehabilitated, or what's his thinking process like. So I was in with him say 6 hours or so, and never using always positive when you get out. Where are you going when you get out? And he says, New York. And I said, New York? I was raised in New York as a kid. I said, man, it's expensive. It's expensive as hell. And he tells me about he's got an ex-con up there. He can get a job, working there. And then I kind of segue into the crimes. I said, what happened the day when you heard the knock on the screen door? And it was Joan D'Alessandro, the seven-year-old girl. And he said, my mother was away at work. And this guy's like 27 at the time. And my grandmother's upstairs sleeping. And he lives in a bi-level house down in the basement part, his bedroom. He says, when I looked up, I knew I was going to kill her, John. I knew I was going to kill her. And so he goes through all the details of what he does to this child. What was so interesting, in fact, I was talking to this parole board head who brought me in on a case back then, just yesterday, was that I wish it was a video, could watch this this play between us, because he, all of a sudden, what you're trying to do is you're trying to turn on that CD in their brain and bring them back to the crime, no matter who it is, or Charles Manson, whatever, whoever you're talking, David Berkowitz, to get them back there. And it takes a while. And so, he starts staring off, and it was freezing in his cell. It was cold. He is sweating. He's sweating profusely, and his chest muscles and his pecs are trembling as he's telling me everything that he's done, all the specifics of his crime. And he would turn around once in a while to make sure the guards weren't watching. Were listening in on this. He trusted me that well. As a matter of fact, they would intercept the letter before it was sent out to a woman that he was communicating with. And he mentions me in the letter saying, I was interviewed by this guy, John Douglas, the FBI, and his behavioral science profiling stuff. And he said, it wasn't until I was well into this interview, I realized he wasn't taking notes, and he didn't have any notes in front of him. He had no papers, mm-hmm. but he knew my case backwards and forwards. He knew everything about him. And see that, so that's one of the other things I learned about doing the interviews. You must maintain contact, eye contact. You're dealing with paranoid people. They don't trust anybody, particularly now that they're in prison. What are you doing? What do you have the audio? They show like in Mindhunter, the audio tape in the beginning, the tape recording. We used it once. We used it what's the guy? The guy you just mentioned a little while ago. Yeah, Kemp. I'm sorry. We use it for Kemper, but they're all. Who's going to listen to this? The warden going to hear this? So mm-hmm. just discard. Same thing. You're thinking, who's going to see these notes here? And so this guy. I mean, going back to McGowan, tells me everything, including. I said, how are you going to live when you get out? Go to New York, but I got money, John. Got money? What? What, make a license plate? What? Have $600,000. And he's always looking back to see if the guards are listening. And how'd you get that? He said, when my mother died, I got insurance money, my grandmother, sale of the house, insurance money. And so I said, where is the money? I put the money out of state. Why'd you put the money out of state? So the family can't get any of the money. Oh man, you'll do great. $600,000 Yeah, you'll be fine when you get to New York. Well, the next day I go before the parole board, and I start telling them what happened and how this interview went down. They're shocked. I'm talking about psychologists, psychiatrists, court appointed people who sit on the parole board. A lot of them are, it's done in every state, have no criminal background and investigative backgrounds at all. And they're shocked. I'm able to get this. And he says, and they refer to him as a pedophile. And I said, he's not a pedophile. Wait, no, he killed a 7-year-old. On that particular day, a parole board, a 70-year-old lady could have knocked on that door and she would have died. He was going to kill somebody. And I gave him the different reasons what was going on in his life, you know, at that time. He's no pedophile. He's a killer. And you let him out of prison, what's going to happen is that you have not rehabilitated him. He was never habilitated to begin with. And so you didn't do anything. You didn't change anything. And all you did was put the physical body on ice for a period of 30 years. But you didn't change what's up in his brain. You didn't change any of that. The fantasies, because when he was telling me about the crime, he was right down to the nitty gritty specifics, you know, of the crime, and no remorse at all. Not a shred of remorse came from this guy. So he'll get out, go up to New York, and things don't go well. Don't believe it. You think that's another theory, that there's burnout with these guys. There's no burnout, because these are crimes of anger and crimes of power. And so, you know, that's what you have to look forward to if you release this guy. So they end up giving him a hit. They gave him on top of that, he gave a 30-year hit. And of course he appeals, but he just died. He died, I think, just last year. You know, he died. Thank goodness they got rid of him.
When a Killer Calls, a haunting story of murder, criminal profiling, and justice in a small town. Mr. Douglas, I love the new book. I know the listeners are going to love it as well. Anything else, any final words about this book, this project, before we wrap up?
No, I think it's good for the people are interested in profiling and how the specifics of how you prepare and things that you can do and can't do. You know, I try to do it with all of the books, and in the next book, whatever we select, we'll do it with that one. But so far, it's got some very, very good reviews, and I think your listeners will enjoy it. And I really appreciate, Nick, you having me on here too. You've really grown over the years. Well, you had a tremendous following.
Well, thank you so much for stopping by and seeing us again. And I hope that you will come by and see us again on the next project.
Oh, I will. Thank you. Please invite me.
Wonderful. Thank you, Mr. Douglas.
Did you miss me? Of course you did, because I missed you. I missed your musk. For everything true crime, check out truecrimegarage.com. And it doesn't get much better than the OG goat talking with the colonel. Until next week, be good, be kind, and don't litter. We'll be right back.